It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. Congress negotiates to renew a sweeping bundle of legislation about every 5 years in the Farm Bill that affects life in Wisconsin. The current Farm Bill is set to expire at the end of this month. And for decades now, a congressman has pushed to overhaul this package, seeking to make it more equitable and cost-effective. You can join the conversation about nutrition and agriculture policy. Call in with a question or comments at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Representative Earl Blumenauer has represented a Portland, Oregon seat in Congress since 1996. Representative Blumenauer, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Well, thank you. I'm a big fan of Wisconsin Public Broadcasting.
Oh.
You're a pioneer.
We are a pioneer. You know your history. Well, talking here about history, for more than two decades, you've been promoting an alternative to the Farm Bill. What is wrong with the Farm Bill?
Well, simply, the Farm Bill pays too much to the wrong people to grow the wrong food the wrong way in the wrong places. The states like Wisconsin get shortchanged. Any state who has great interest in promoting small and medium-sized family farms, if it has a diverse agricultural base, they're cheated. The subsidies flow to six states that produce the commodities. Very little goes to what we would call the production of food, fruit and vegetables, nuts and berries. The subsidization is tilted in terms of people who really don't need it. And last but not least, we're subsidizing a diet that makes Americans sick. Other than that, it's just fine.
Well, Wisconsin farmers received $728 million in farm subsidies in 2021, according to the Environmental Working Group. And that includes $443 million for commodity programs, $204 million for crop insurance. How do subsidies affect what crops are grown or what livestock is raised in Wisconsin?
Well, the people who are involved with small and medium-sized activities, dairy, for instance. I mean, this is one of the areas that you're looking at that has tremendous implications if this Republican Congress cannot actually be able to enact a farm bill. The dairy price supports expire if they're not reauthorized by the end of the year. It reverts back to a 1940 law. Mm. It is too much directed towards the activities that produce the largest results in terms of subsidization rather than what's good for the environment or really what the markets need.
Back to what you said earlier about how you said small farmers are being cheated. What do you see there? I mean, you want to end subsidies for large animal farm operations, industrial farm operations. Why is that?
Well, as a practical matter, what we're doing here is squeezing out small and medium-sized producers. The large confined animal feedlot operations are bad for the environment, water quality, air quality. And what we're seeing is that the typical farmer has fewer and fewer choices about who they sell their products to. There are four large producers for pork, for poultry. At a time of record high beef prices, the amount that goes to the farmer that produces it is shrinking. The system is upside down.
We're talking about an alternative to the Farm Bill with Congressman Earl Blumenauer of Oregon, and you can join the conversation about farming and farm subsidies. The number to join in is 800-642-1234 with your question or comments. Congressman, how do you propose incentivizing sustainable farming practices?
Well, first of all, what we ought to do is to make the environmental programs be performance-based. Every year, there are many, many farmers in Wisconsin, that would like to have access to the environmental programs, but they are underfunded. We run out of money for deserving projects. And some of the money goes for things that are just the cost of doing business. They're not enhancing the environment. Why should we provide federal subsidy for confined animal feedlot operations? Taking care of that in an environmentally responsible fashion is just simply the cost of doing business. That does not help the vast majority of farmers and ranchers in Wisconsin that would like to have access to these environmental programs. They should be based on the amount of environmental benefit.
What effect have special interests had on the Farm Bill or lobbies as you talk about these large operations and the influence there?
Well, make no mistake about it. The farm lobby is large, well-funded, and it operates 24 hours a day, 365 days a year. One of the most, I think, dramatic examples of where contributions make a big difference deals with the sugar program. The American consumer pays about twice the world price for sugar products. It's driven confectionery business out of the United States to Canada and other places. The operation, however, in terms of the sugar lobby is very strong, putting restrictions on what can be imported. We have about 1% of American agricultural production is sugar, but it's 17% of American agricultural political contributions. And we have a situation where we're subsidizing cane sugar, for example, in Florida, over 400,000 acres, which contributes to the pollution of the Everglades. And frankly, much of this flows to the two largest contributors to the Democratic Party and the Republican Party happen to be a pair of Cuban immigrants who control the largest sugar operation in the country. It really is insidious, and the American consumer and the environment pays the price.
With the environment, your legislation would create an animal welfare tax incentive. How would farmers qualify for this?
We have, for the first time, would establish a animal welfare title, enable support for more sustainable and humane practices. We slaughter about 9 billion animals a year, and being able to provide more humane treatment in terms of how the products are raised, in terms of more mechanisms, in terms of in having the Department of Agriculture actually enforce animal welfare standards more aggressively. These are things that will make a difference in terms of the confidence that the products we have are produced in a humane and thoughtful fashion.
Representative Earl Blumenauer of Oregon, seeking to overhaul the Farm Bill, shift how agriculture and nutrition policies work in our country and here in Wisconsin. You can be part of this discussion, call in with a question. Share your perspectives at 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. A congressman from Oregon wants the Farm Bill reauthorization to improve the food our country produces and what we have access to eat. They offer an alternative vision for this sweeping legislative package that expires at the end of this month. And as we discuss ways to overhaul farm and food policy and a new farm bill, call in to ask a question or share your views at 800-642-1234. Representative Earl Blumenauer of Oregon is with us. Let's bring in Jim now in Hudson. Hi, Jim. What would you like to bring up?
Thanks for having me. It's a really important topic you're talking about. And I'd like to point out, the farm bill impacts, the health of people in this country so much as well, because the public school system is really the biggest fast food. It's not really a corporation, but it provides more food and meals to people in this country than any other, McDonald's or whatever else. And the quality of the food provided for school lunches is for the most part quite poor. The USDA supports sugar companies and the pop industry, and all of these things contribute to a really unhealthy lifestyle here in the United States, with diabetes and obesity being such a problem. And if we had better foods, getting to people, it would really decrease the cost of our health care, too. It's such an important topic.
Jim, thank you for joining in. Congressman, how could you see changes to how nutrition policies work in our country?
Well, we have a specific title in my bill that would increase access to healthy food in food deserts, other underserved areas. He's right about the critical nature of school nutrition, and for that matter, at farmers markets through SNAP and other initiatives. The soaring costs of health care in this country directly tied to diet. Obesity, diabetes, these are diet-related conditions that drive our health care spending and undermine the health of the American public. There's tremendous evidence that being able to subsidize more healthy food, like fruits and vegetables, you can have food as medicine. Healthcare providers are providing healthy food and showing savings for their health care plans. My legislation would be able to provide incentives in that fashion.
And, noting here, more than 3/4 of the current farm bill goes toward nutrition assistance programs. Yeah. One of those programs, as you mentioned, being SNAP, the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program. It benefits more than 700,000 Wisconsin residents, and your proposal would expand food assistance funding. How would you do that?
Well, we would increase the areas, the amount of money of funding that goes into it. What we see now as an approach, and I am saddened by what some of my Republican friends are arguing, is to increase the limits for access to nutrition, have more stringent limitations about who would qualify. We ought to be expanding that. Unfortunate that they're looking at restricting access to nutrition for low and moderate income people when there are 20,000 farmers who have received $1 million a year or more for 37 consecutive years. We ought to expand access for low and moderate income people and rein in these subsidies for people who don't need them.
Your proposal would change the crop insurance program that is part of the farm bill. What is problematic with how crop insurance works today?
Well, it's too narrowly drawn. For the vast majority of farmers and ranchers cannot get access to it. It is designed for large commodity productions. And frankly, the crop insurance program guarantees an extraordinarily high rate of return we spend $2 billion on people who just sell the insurance for a program that's guaranteed. We need to tighten the economic elements of crop insurance provision and make it so that it is less of a rich entitlement. And as I mentioned, those 20,000 examples of $1 million a year or more is, I think, something we can no longer afford when we have unmet needs for research, for environment, and for nutrition.
Do you see crop insurance like subsidies, or how are those two different from each other?
Well, it is a massive subsidy. There, the way the system is designed, some people can plant crops they know will fail and make money off of it. We ought to try and make sure that the crop insurance program is designed for people who need it the most, particularly the things that are basically excluded right now. When you're talking about fruits and vegetables, which most people would regard as food, it's very, very difficult for them to have crop insurance. They're not protected in the case of disasters. But as I mentioned, in terms of the commodity programs, that's almost a guaranteed revenue stream for the agents, for the large commodity that plant and take advantage of it, and for people who are having a more diverse stream of agricultural products, they can't qualify.
Talking about a new vision for the Farm Bill with Democratic Congressman Earl Blumenauer of Oregon, you can join in with your questions and your perspective at 800-642-1234. Congressman, Congress is struggling with negotiations over the Farm Bill, is expected to miss the September 30th deadline to renew it. That's according to an industry publication, Successful Farming. And given your objections to the Farm Bill, would failing to renew it be a bad thing?
Well, I think we have an opportunity for people to deal meaningfully with the areas of reform. You're having a very narrowly balanced Congress. The Ag Committee is split, Republicans and Democrats even. If the forces of reform are growing in Congress, people who care about animal welfare, about research, about equity, about nutrition, those needs are going to have to be accommodated, I think, in order for the bill to pass. It gives us unusual leverage. The Senate chair of the Ag Committee, Debbie Stabenow from Michigan, this is her last session of Congress. This is her swan song, and she's been sympathetic towards reform. So I think the elements are lining up, and if there isn't some movement to take care of some of the more egregious problems, the people who were shut out, for instance, and not dealing with the nutrition deficits, I don't think they get the votes to move forward. I think that gives leverage, the unprecedented leverage, for people who want to make it better. I mentioned the stake that Wisconsin has in this. If the Farm Bill is not reauthorized, at the end of the calendar year, we revert back to a 1940 law that bases the subsidy based on how far you are from Eau Claire, Wisconsin, which used to be the center of the dairy productions. That would dramatically disadvantage the state of Wisconsin. So I think you've got leverage to try and make some changes.
The Farm Bill is a vast piece of legislation that you know well, and 2018 version was almost $500 billion. Do lawmakers understand its complexity?
No. As a practical matter, I think it's safe to say virtually no one can understand all of these facets. In fact, the noted nutritionist Marion Nussel from NYU actually tried to teach a seminar on the Farm Bill, and she concluded that it was hopelessly complex, that nobody understood it except for their little narrow provision. And that helps provide support. People can't dive in. They don't understand crop insurance. They're not being fully versed with the intricacies of research. And that helps protect things like the bizarre sugar system. The complexity works in their favor, sad to say, and it's time to try and cut through some of that.
Representative Blumenauer, thank you for joining us.
Been my pleasure.
Earl Blumenauer has represented a Portland, Oregon seat in Congress since 1996. His farm bill alternative is called the Food and Farm Act. And yesterday in Central Time, a Politico reporter explained the negotiations over renewing the farm bill. Go to WPR.org to listen to that conversation. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We explore a ProPublica investigation about flaws in the Navy's combat shipbuilding program with ties to Wisconsin. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a story about finding home within yourself.
How do you travel halfway around the world and still feel connected to home? For WPR's Karina Abrego-Cook of Green Bay, she listened to the sound of her own voice and the voice of someone she loves. She shares her story as part of the Home Is Here project, which amplifies the voices of the growing number of Black, Asian, Native American, and Hispanic residents who call northeastern Wisconsin home.
Two things about me that you need to know for this story. I've always been loud and proud about my family's background and where I come from. Also, I'm an Anglophile, meaning I'm obsessed with British culture. It started with my love of Tears for Fears when I was 3, and then the Beatles in my teen years. Growing up, I was always forthcoming about my heritage. My family moved from Kenosha to Green Bay in 1987, and there weren't many people who looked anything like me in northeast Wisconsin. So people often flat out asked me, "What are you?" I'm half Mexican, a quarter Japanese, an eighth Irish, and an eighth Norwegian. I'd joke that I'm diverse within myself, or I'd make a new term calling myself Hispasian, or triracial. I remember one time when I was 12, I was talking about our family background, and my dad said, "Yeah, but if you travel outside the country, you aren't gonna say that. You're gonna tell them you're American." That stuck with me my entire life. I had to wait another 12 years to leave the country to see how an exchange with someone from outside the country might go. My friend Sean asked me if I wanted to join him in London for his spring break. It was the trip of a lifetime. While there, we dined with a group of Romanian college students. My family background eventually came up in conversation, and their jaws dropped. They had never met someone with such a diverse background. In a way, it was a new experience for me too, because as Americans, we're used to people having ancestors from more than one country. My trip to London not only got me thinking about my triracial identity, but also my Wisconsin accent. You know the accent with its long vowels. Now, something strange happened in my short time in London. As the week progressed, my friend and I noticed my accent changing. One morning at a coffee shop, I ordered an Americano and I didn't recognize the voice that came out of my mouth. I didn't sound like my Wisconsin self. In fact, I sounded a little British. I was in London for less than a week and I was taking on bits of their accent. I was not totally surprised though. I've always been able to imitate or mimic others easily, though this time it was subconscious mimicking. Was it because I wanted to be British? Not for the food, but you know, the music and the culture, of course. Later that week, we went to the loudest Irish pub on St. Patrick's Day, and I struck up a conversation with a guy from Australia. I'm not sure how he could hear it, but he said I sounded like I was from Canada. And I laughed and I told him that I was from not far from there. So my Wisconsin accent wasn't completely gone. The next day was the moment I was really looking forward to during the whole trip. It was the visit to Abbey Road Studios. After doing all the touristy Beatle things and posing for photos, I couldn't wait to tell my dad about my adventure. After all, he bought me my first Beatles CD, Rubber Soul. Incidentally, it was the first Beatles album he had. I found one of those iconic red British phone booths to call my musician dad, who always fostered my love of music. After he answered, I told him how I walked across Abbey Road barefoot like Paul McCartney and peeped through the studio's iron gates. And it was at that moment, my friend said, that my northeast Wisconsin accent came back completely, It's because I was talking to Dad in Green Bay. Wherever my dad is, that's home. My name is Karina. I'm half Mexican, a quarter Japanese, an eighth Irish, and an eighth Norwegian. I call Green Bay home, and you can hear it in my Wisconsin-accented voice.
Karina Abrego-Cook is an outreach specialist with Wisconsin Public Radio. And her story is part of the Home is Here project from the New News Lab, a local news collaboration in northeastern Wisconsin made up of six media organizations, including WPR and the Green Bay Press Gazette. More information can be found at wisconsinlife.org. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. I'm Maureen McCollum.
It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We learn about the Navy's troubled littoral combat vessel program and connections to a shipyard in Wisconsin as the Navy announced the decommissioning of the USS Milwaukee this month, bidding farewell to the ship in a ceremony in Florida. Be part of the conversation by calling in with a question, share comments at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Joaquin Sapien is a reporter for ProPublica. Joaquin, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Good morning. Starting with the USS Milwaukee, decommissioned 8 years after it was built for $500 million in Marinette, Wisconsin. Why is the Navy removing this littoral combat ship and others from its fleet?
So the Navy's decided that the Freedom Class littoral combat ships, of which the USS Milwaukee is a part, are not really going to help it meet its top line needs, which are to prepare for a potential fight against the Chinese Navy. And in particular, the Navy has decided that because of the failures in the anti-submarine warfare package that the USS Milwaukee and other Freedom Class ships were supposed to have, because of those the failures in that package, that the ship is just not going to do enough good. It's not going to have enough fight in it for its top line priority. There's also a number of mechanical issues on these Freedom Class ships involving the combining gear, which is a really complex and important mechanism that connects the diesel engines to the propulsion shafts and helps it reach its top speeds. There's been really serious issues in that gear, and they're expensive to fix. And even though they've come up with a fix for those, the expense of it has contributed to that decision as well. So essentially, the Navy's decided that it's better off spending the money elsewhere. So right now, there are several Freedom Class ships that are scheduled for decommissioning, and the Navy also wants to decommission a couple of the Independence variant as well.
We're going to rewind here to the early 2000s. The Navy contracts with two American shipyards to build these combat ships, and one of them was in Alabama, other in Marinette, Wisconsin, and its Italian subsidiary, Fincantieri. What problems did the Navy experience with these ships, particularly the ones built here in Wisconsin?
So there were a range of problems. Like I had mentioned earlier, the mechanical difficulties on the Freedom were a major issue. There's a part called the combining gear that the Navy had a lot of difficulty with in trying to get the ship to reach its top speeds. It would frequently break down. And the Milwaukee, for instance, when it first left the shipyard, was supposed to go to eventually San Diego as its home port, with stops along the way in Mayport, Florida, then going through the Panama Canal and onto California and out to the South China Sea. And unfortunately, it broke down not even halfway, just outside of Virginia, about 40 miles off the coast, and it had to be towed in by a salvage ship. And that was just the first of several breakdowns that occurred around that same time between 2015 and 2016. There was also a breakdown out in Singapore on the USS Fort Worth, which was another Freedom Class ship. And in that instance, the ship was being sort of was being pushed really hard, and the sailors on it were exhausted, and they had failed to lubricate the combining gear before turning it on, which caused some serious damage and required repairs for some 7 months. And then after that, there was another ship, the USS Freedom, which was the first in that class, which had broken down during the Rim of the Pacific exercise in San Diego, which is a hugely important exercise involving navies all over the world. A leak sprung out of the main machinery room and sprayed on the electric equipment and caused really serious problems that required that engine to eventually be replaced. And those were just three of many, many more breakdowns that occurred on those vessels. And in addition to that, you know, the original idea was that the ship was going to be modular in nature and could switch weapons packages depending on the mission. So it was supposed to be able to do mine warfare, hunt and detect underwater mines. It was supposed to be able to fight against submarines, and it was supposed to be able to do anti-surface warfare against other warships. And unfortunately, you know, two of those three weapon systems, never came to fruition. One of them, the mine warfare, there is still under development, and the anti-submarine warfare, the Navy just gave up on altogether. And so now they're just single mission ships.
I think you wrote about the USS Milwaukee. Its worst enemy would be its own engine. And as you say, you know, you had these frustrated scores of sailors on these ships expressing frustration because they spent more time fixing the ships than sailing them. When ships spend long periods of time docked for repairs, how does that affect the careers of the personnel assigned to them?
Yeah, that's an important question. So, you know, originally the Navy had sort of sold these ships as being the future of the Navy and made it seem really exciting for sailors and officers to serve on them, in part because the crew sizes were so small and the deployment schedules were supposed to be very aggressive. And so the idea was that they were going to, you know, sort of give the people on board them opportunities that they wouldn't have otherwise. Unfortunately, what happened was that the ships were broken down so often that the sailors and officers spent more time trying to fix them than they did taking them to sea. And that's a real problem if you're a young surface warfare officer looking to climb the ranks, because you need those hours at sea in order to, you know, gain necessary experience for promotions. And so a number of the officers and sailors that I spoke to said that their careers really suffered as a result of having been assigned to this particular ship, because as I said, you know, they weren't able to take them out to sea. Not only that, but they really weren't even allowed to fix certain parts of the ship because of the way that the contracts were arranged with the contractors that built the ship.
We're going to look more closely at the contractors with ProPublica reporter Joaquin Sapien, our guide to the breakdowns in the Navy's littoral combat ship program that was supposed to launch this branch of the military into the future, ties to a shipyard in Wisconsin. You can share what you wonder about this investigative reporting. Call in with a question. Add your perspective at 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. A new report from ProPublica is an in-depth look at the Navy's littoral combat ship program and the costly phase-out of these vessels, some built at a shipyard in Wisconsin. You can join the discussion. Call in with the question. Share your thoughts at 800-642-1234. We have Joaquin Sapien, a reporter at ProPublica. Joaquin, you report that this program faced criticism, including from the late Arizona Senator John McCain. Why was funding continued while these reports of engine and system failures kept piling up?
One of the things that we learned was that even when a program of this scale has really serious problems, once they're sort of started, they can be very, very difficult to stop. And part of the reason why is because these shipyards that produce these ships, as well as the places that produce parts for the ships, provide jobs. And lawmakers that represent those districts fight really hard to keep those jobs in place. And so certainly what we found in this particular instance is that delegations in both Alabama and Wisconsin wanted to make sure that the program stayed alive and that the Navy keep producing these ships, even when they had serious problems. The other part of that is that, you know, within the Navy itself and within the Pentagon, there were very dogged, you know, champions that believed in this program in spite of its flaws. And people wind up kind of staking their careers on these particular ships. And so they will fight against great odds to make sure that the program continues. And that's what we found in the case of this particular ship. So between, you know, the high-ranking officers in the Navy, in this case, we had CNO Vernon Clark, who first envisioned the ship, as well as Navy Secretary Ray Mabus, who kind of took up the mantle later on in 2009 through 2016, and the lawmakers in both Wisconsin and Alabama, they were able to preserve this program. And, you know, at one point, the Navy decided it only wanted 32 of these ships down from the original more than 50, but they still got wound up with 35 because Congress essentially forced them to build three more.
And I want to stop you there at Congress, because in 2017, we have Wisconsin Senator Tammy Baldwin writing a letter to then President Donald Trump suggesting they could work together to get more littoral combat ships built. What was the result of Baldwin's advocacy?
So, yeah, at that time, you know, the Navy was looking to slow down the program significantly. They said that, you know, 32 of these ships would be enough. And in 2017, they submitted in the budget a request for only one littoral combat ship. And Senator Baldwin, as you mentioned, wrote to President Trump. There were others who also leaned on him, and he ultimately made a decision. It really shocked the defense community to add one more ship to the budget at a pretty late stage after it had already been sent to Congress. And so ultimately, from there on, they added three more ships, and the Navy got 35 as opposed to 32.
You sought comment from Senator Baldwin. What did she say?
She said she was very proud to represent the shipyard, and she said that, you know, she believed strongly that this ship was going to help the Navy meet its needs. And so it was her obligation to advocate for it.
We're talking about the littoral combat ships built for the U.S. Navy with ties to Wisconsin. ProPublica investigative reporter Joaquin Sapien is with us. You can join in with your questions, your comments, 800-642-1234. Joaquin, what does the Navy do with ships it doesn't wish to keep maintaining and operating?
So it goes through a process called decommissioning, and that means that the ship is basically taken offline and into a graveyard, and they have those graveyards all throughout the country for ships that no longer are in the fleet. And so, you know, my understanding is that some of the LCS are located in a town called Bremerton, and at a shipyard there, and that, you know, that's they're basically going to just be sitting there until the Navy figures out what to do with them. The Navy might try and sell some of these LCS, and so we'll have to see how successful they are in doing that.
This week, the $826 billion defense appropriations bill is scheduled to come to the House floor for a vote. How closely do members of Congress scrutinize spending on these specific military programs at this point in the process?
Yeah, I mean, so there's a pretty, you know, the Defense Department is asking for a lot of money this year, $842 billion. They'll probably wind up with quite a bit more than that once it goes through Congress. And, you know, we're not far off from $1 trillion a year defense budget, which is almost half of the federal government's discretionary spending. And so there's a lot of programs to fund within the military. It's obviously a massive organization, and typically there's not a lot of time spent on weapon systems like the LCS that have also cost a lot of money but haven't actually produced. And so, you know, we'll see, but I'd be very surprised if this ship program, you know, comes up in some of the discussions around whatever that final number should be.
We're in our last 30 seconds together. You mentioned this mantra, though, in your piece, buy a few, test a lot. Is that something that we should take away here?
I think that's a pretty key point, especially when you're investing in relatively unproven technology. That has long been a cardinal principle when it comes to Navy shipbuilding, that it's important to basically know what you're buying and to test drive it. And in this instance, the Navy did the opposite. I mean, they started off with just a few ships, with two coming out of Alabama and two coming out of Wisconsin. But then they made a decision to buy essentially 20 at once, 10 out of Alabama and 10 out of Wisconsin. And so they really did the opposite.
Joaquin, and they, thank you so much for joining us, and thank you for sharing your reporting.
Thank you for having me.
Joaquin Sapien is a reporter at ProPublica. We have a link to his reporting at wpr.org/mornings. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network.